hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Andrea. I grew up originally in Richmond, Virginia. I lived there most of my life. I've struggled with alcohol and addiction since, from what I can recognize now, probably around age 11 or 12. My clean date is March 11th of 2017. Childhood was chaotic. You know, I can't say it was really terrible. It wasn't bad. I wasn't really, you know, terribly abused. I was raised kind of away from church in a broken family. My parents split very young. And I remember kind of all the fight between them. I really didn't know which path to follow, so I kind of just went out on my own. And learning from my own experience, I switched houses between parents a lot. When I lived with my father was when I began kind of rebelling and not wanting to take any direction. That escalated a lot. My depression hit me pretty bad around age 11. I started acting out and lashing out towards myself as well as other family members, and it was time. My family had had enough of me even at that point that it was time to move back with my mom. After moving back with my mom was really when the addiction started hitting me. I think it was around, I was just before I had turned 12 that I got into drinking for the first time, smoking for the first time, becoming promiscuous for the first time. Very young, and it was like I liked it. I wanted it. I didn't know any other way to live. I didn't know any other right decision to make. I remember defying God, not thinking he was there, you know, thinking it was just me, even at, you know, 11 or 12, walking around town wanting that attention and looking for that trouble to get in, if that makes sense. And through my teenage years, it really just kind of escalated. It got worse and worse. You know, any new thing I could get my hands on, any way to rebel and get that excitement, whether it be drugs or boys or running away from home, getting chased by the cops, I wanted it. And around age 14, I got into cocaine. I spent a lot of time living with my drug dealer, kind of off and on with whatever kind of relationship that is between a female and male drug dealer, if you catch kind of where I'm going with that. I was in and out of court, mostly on alcohol charges, curfew charges, being underage. Once I hit 16 or 17 was when I became so conceited I wanted everyone to see me as something that they would want, whether it be friendship, you know, the way I was living my life, you know, I was going to all these parties, I was the young girl with blonde hair. I got really bad into ecstasy. You know, alcohol and pot were just kind of something that we always did. We always had. It wasn't a big deal. Ecstasy brought me down a lot. That was something I did pretty frequently to the point where I would wake up one morning and be at home. You know, there were no plans for the day. My parents were, you know, doing housework, and I just decided to pop ecstasy. And I didn't know what I was putting in my body at the time, but I remember just sitting on the couch beside my mom, and the clock started melting. I was like, Mom, the clock is melting. You know, I had no idea what this was that I was putting in my body. And that terrifies me, you know. Through my experience, I've had several people, you know, starting from my youth that were killed. Just being involved with, you know, drugs and just bad behavior. I think the first friend of mine that passed away from drugs, I was 14. He was 15, and he was murdered. Some sort of drug deal gone wrong in Richmond, Virginia. They had found him with his head bashed in, his pants pulled down, his fingernails torn off. And this was someone that I used to just sit on the back porch with and smoke a blunt. I still have diary entries like, hey, I went and, you know, hung out with so-and-so today. We just chit-chatted. And at 15, it's hard to think now, 15, that his life was taken from him. He was, you know, he wouldn't harm a fly. We worked together in a kitchen, you know, smoking pot together. And it's crazy how far this thing takes you. The second friend I lost to drugs and alcohol was a victim of suicide. He had taken a bad batch of hallucinogens and ended up stabbing himself in the neck. And so I always wanted to stay away from these things that made me hallucinate and see things. That was always my line. Like, I can do these drugs, but this is where I crossed the line. So kind of thinking, like, you know, I'm not that bad. And I remember taking that ecstasy pill and hallucinating, and it just scared me because I thought of James and how he left and how it really was kind of almost out of his control. You know, I'm sure he didn't wake up that day planning to get high and kill himself. And I remember I missed his funeral because of my addiction, because I was too busy trying to seek my high. I was not there for someone that cared about me a lot, related to him. I really wasn't showing up where I needed to be in life the day that he passed away. That was when I really started getting away from drugs besides alcohol, I guess. In my mind, I didn't really see that I had a problem. I didn't see as alcohol being what would take me under. It was something that was so frequently used that everyone could get. I became involved with the community. And I guess that was kind of my excuse. Like, you know, I don't do drugs. I can drink. Like, this is my vice. Everyone has their vice. It really started to damage my life when I was around 21. I was involved in a relationship with a young guy. We were both, you know, big partiers, big drinkers, but I still had that stigma against anything besides alcohol because I thought mine was better. And I remember I had caught him at a party one time doing some drugs, and I wanted to leave, and it turned pretty violent. You know, he didn't want me to leave until I tried, you know, the same thing he was doing, just to show me it was okay and I should relax and it wasn't that bad. And I used to really blame him for this kind of period in my life, and, you know, what this is leading up to. But truth be told, I didn't really fight it as much as I should have, because deep down inside I was like, you know, I've done drugs, you know, fine, I'll enjoy the high, we'll see what happens. And later that night, I guess the violence kind of escalated. I woke up with a black eye the next day and learned that I had hit him over the head with one of my bottles of wine. It had broken over his head. I was taken to jail for a class 4 felony charge of malicious wounding. And I remember I spent about 3 days in jail, went before the judge. My parents put their house up as a deed to bail me out. And even that then affects my life now. I can't pursue the career that my heart is set on because I have a violent charge, which was later dropped to a misdemeanor, but it still shows up. And the truth is, I put myself in that position. I put myself in that situation. I had choices that I could have made, and I made the wrong ones. That period kind of passed. I was off and on. I still drank. I still enjoyed it. Still went out. Nothing had really broken me down inside yet. I guess I hadn't really hit a bottom. And I didn't really see how that would play out in my future and affect my life. So I kept drinking. You know, I focused really hard on my work. I went through a period that was really good. I excelled through all of the departments. I was in a supervisor position at a veterinary clinic, as well as taking a lot of lead and initiative in the treatment area. And I was doing really well, and I was proud of myself. And I'm the kind of person where if I do something well, like, I want to feel like I did something well, but I want you to tell me about it too. And that's my pride. Like, I really want to look good for you. And what I've learned about recovery is that is absolutely not how it works. Absolutely not. You got to get really, it gets really, really, really nasty when you take a look at yourself. So things were going really well. I started drinking a lot more. I had one damaging relationship, failed, you know, relationship after the other. I wonder why. And I remember it was the summer of 2015. I had just finished my prerequisites for nursing and was going into the nursing program, and I was drinking heavier than I ever had before in my life. I was missing work. I was crying every single day, just really laying around my apartment, you know, in the summer heat, no air conditioning, just drinking, you know, bottle of whiskey after bottle of whiskey. I smoked a little pot here and there. You know, my boss kind of pinpointed what was going on, And I was very blessed to have the boss that I did back then. She believed in me. We had a friendship outside of work. We went to church. We had a very close, really authentic relationship. And, you know, she told me to take some time to myself, get better. And I kind of thought, you know, yeah, I'm messing up, but, you know, I've still got this. You know, I can still drink a little bit, just not as much. And so I started doing better. But people started to notice I was coming to work with alcohol in my breath, and I was slow, and I was jittery and nervous, and that was when I really felt like I was starting to hide something, but I wasn't ready to let it go. I wasn't ready to let my drinking go. It was the only thing I knew in my life to make me feel better, besides my dog. And I remember that winter, you know, my drinking just got worse and worse. There were periods where I would work for about a month and then I would just miss all of my shifts. I would tell my boss, you know, I'm not well, I'm struggling, I don't know what to do. And that went on for about a year. It was beginning of 2016. I had taken about 2 months straight off of work to drink. They were still trying to work with me, and I had gone out one night just really for dinner and drinks with a girlfriend. Just like a normal, it was a Wednesday night, you know, nothing terrible. I wasn't dancing on tables. There was no huge situation. It was just dinner, which you would think was normal. And I ended up getting pulled over for a DUI with a BAC of 0.3. That was my normal Wednesday night, was going to dinner and driving around with a 0.3. And I continued to drink like that for about 9 more months, heavily every day. There were times, you know, I would black out. I would evidently, you know, puke across the room. I would lash out violently at my boyfriends. My friends would have to bathe me in the shower, and evidently I would just be crying, covered in vomit. And I wouldn't even remember this. I was told that I would cry out about my drinking and just about how lost I was as a person. I had no idea where I was, who I was, or how to get out of it. I remember sitting in my living room crying to a friend, just saying, I don't know where I am. I could comprehend I was in my living room, but I had no idea where I was in life, in me. And I continued to drink, you know? And I remember things had come crashing down. It was summer of 2016. My relationship had ended. I had resigned from my position on the rescue squad that I had volunteered with because I felt like it really was a disservice to the public in the state I was in. And my pride was so hurt, I still could not quit drinking. It was the only thing I knew. I knew I had a drinking problem. So what did I do about that problem? What I did about every problem. I continued drinking. It's insane. I had lost my job at the clinic at this point, lost my boyfriend, lost my position at the rescue squad, and I didn't know how to pay rent. And I remember going around my apartment complex, trying to have a conversation with neighbors and my landlords. I was out of breath, you know, even when I hadn't drank that much the next day, like I would have gotten blackout, just shit-faced, wasted, drunk, excuse my language, the night before, wake up. I remember my face twitching. I couldn't talk. I couldn't form words, you know, even without putting any alcohol in my body for that day. It was like my senses, my nervous system was shutting down, with or without it. And my landlords were the ones that ended up calling a wellness check to the Radford City Police Department. They knocked on my door. You know, from my experience on the rescue squad, I knew that they were here to help. A lot of people were like, oh, no, fuck the police. Like, they're people, too. And I remember talking with them in my living room. My apartment was a mess, and I told them, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm struggling with this. And I was crying, you know, poor, pitiful me. And I remember one of the officers saying, you know what, me too, that he was an alcoholic. And I just kind of looked at him, and even there was, like, a little bit of hope. Like, it's something that's always been a desire in my heart the older I get, is to help other people. But I knew I was too sick to do that at that point. The next few days, I really started reaching out in the local meetings. You know, I was told that the only requirement for membership was the desire to stop drinking. And I saw that as an excuse. I was like, so I can have friends with you guys, but I can keep drinking. That's not the point. And I remember sitting outside of my apartment with my sponsor. I had this huge bottle of wine hiding in the back of my car from her. And I remember just really feeling that intimate moment with God. It was the first time I had really felt him since, you know, being lost in all the chaos. And I saw almost like from outside of myself this bottle of wine in my car and what it was doing to me and the role it had in my life and how it was bringing me down. The next few days, I struggled to drink less, but I couldn't do it. And I was so mad at this bottle of alcohol, and I was so mad at myself, and I was so confused. Like, I don't know what to do to stop this. I remember reaching out and calling to a bunch of hotlines for addiction, and I ended up getting on the phone with this gentleman named Terrence from the American Addictions Corporation, or Center, sorry. And he talked to me for the next several days. I remember he set up, a flight to, I think it was Missouri or Indiana, so I could finally go into rehab. I said no. I ended up in the hospital with, I think, a 0.41 BAC. And I had talked to him again, and I was like, no, I really need help this time. And he was like, the next available one we have is Las Vegas. And even this was kind of like crappy. I was like, well, you know what? I've never been to Las Vegas. Why don't I go? Like, it's ironic, and it's going to get me out of where I am. One of my biggest fears before deciding to check myself into rehab was losing my dog. I had lost everything else, and I had had her with me for 7 years. And Terrence found a way to find kind of like an adoption foster agency that was willing to watch her for free for 30 or so days while I went and got help for myself. And it was just a miracle, just a blessing that he was able to do that. So it was October 16th of 2016. I kind of told my parents, I was like, you know what, I'm finally going to rehab. And they didn't believe me at that point, but I just got on the plane and went. They were all pissed at me anyways. I remember being so nervous and so confused on the flight. I was just like, what am I doing? Like, what just happened to my life? Like, I just left everything behind. And that night, laying in bed in the detox house was the first night I felt like I could breathe. I felt safe. Like something had just opened up. And I remember just a series of breaking down and letting go. And it was just gentle. I feel like God really moved me out of where my tiny little apartment in, a small town in Southwest Virginia to Las Vegas, of all places, where I found him again. And rehab through solutions was an amazing experience for me. It was a second chance that was a gift that sometimes I lose sight of still today. I get distracted from where I want my life to go with things that are shiny and right in front of me. I really learned a lot from my experience in rehab. I didn't really realize at the time going through the program just how sick we are as addicts struggling to recover, seeing it for the first time. I did not have any idea just how sick we were spiritually, as well as physically. I had found, in my addiction, I felt so alone. Like, I felt like no one else was going through the same thing, and that's just part of what it does. And while going through solutions, it was crazy. I was finally talking about what had gone on with me, and I met all these people that were right there with me. I didn't feel alone. It was my first huge glance at recovery and what it can do for people, and I wanted it. It felt good. It felt bright. It felt like where I should be as far as continuing to do well with my life and save my life. And, while I was in solutions, I kept wondering, what am I going to do when I go home? Like, I don't have the apartment. I don't have a job. I don't have anything. And the idea was kind of planted in my head, you could relocate. You could stay here. And I was like, no, that's impossible. And I finally started thinking about it. I was like, maybe I should try. And it was like everything just fell into place. I called for job interviews. I had a job lined up. I called around at, some sublet apartments. I had a perfect apartment set up. All I had to do was go home and get my dog. And it just presented itself as an opportunity, really, to kind of push me forward. And that's really what it felt like. It felt like a safer place for me to be, to kind of completely restart my life. I ended up going back home for about 10 days to pack up the rest of my things, to see my family, to get my car fixed up. I went and visited the rescue squad and captain and not really made amends to them at that point, but was just like, you know, thank you for your opportunity and your chance and really seeing this for me and supporting me in it. And I ended up, I just drove back across the country. It was awesome. It was such an adventure that I never thought I would have the opportunity to do, which I wouldn't have if I had never, you know, gotten sober. I drove across the country in about 4 days and landed in my little sublet apartment and started work, I think, a week after that. Getting involved in treatment, it was really, the experience that I had had in rehab was really uplifting, and it was almost like kind of a, like, hope that I was holding on to, which is part of what moved me back here. I definitely wanted to stay involved with people that understood where I had been, that could lead me to where, you know, I should go to learn more about it. I really just had to put that hope in the program, and the fellowship, and really just trusting God with it. It was just a good feeling. It felt like hope, and that's what I held on to. So relapse is a part of my story. I never wanted it to be, but I think in the end it could have been a good thing based on some of my character defects. I moved back. I did really well. I was still with the same kind of group of friends that I had gone through treatment with. I had begun working the steps, but I couldn't quite grasp. I had the knowledge just from going through the book, but it wasn't resonating in my heart. I still had this, you know, I've got this beat. I got sober. I'm going to do this so great, and you'll see my recovery. And you know, I'm just going to be this bright, shining star, the girl that got sober, you know, first go around, never walked back across that street. I got distracted from recovery. I had forgotten how bad it felt being in that apartment suffering. I had forgotten all the friends that I had lost to addiction, and, you know, that lifestyle. I really forgot about, I'll go ahead and say it, the death. How deadly this can be and the feeling of that. And so I kind of just had this, like, yeah, but attitude. You know, I would get suggestions, and I'd be like, you know what, I'm going to do that, but I'm going to do it this way. And it ran me into the ground. I get distracted by shiny things sometimes, and I wasn't really putting my recovery and my life and my serenity first. I bounced around from apartment to apartment, because everywhere I was, it looked like people, you know, left and right were going back out and relapsing and doing drugs, and I still knew, like, I didn't want to be that person to relapse, and I guess I kind of looked down on them, and still wanted to be that, you know, beacon of hope that I was, you know, still sober through all of this, and I ended up really falling asleep in my life. I slept a lot. I wasn't really taking the depression medications as prescribed that I was supposed to. Just trying to self-medicate. It was that vicious cycle that I just slipped back down into. Even I was like, you know, it's prescribed to me. I feel a little sad today. I'm going to take another. And that was really the beginning of my relapse, was taking it back into my control, and not listening to people warn me, like, this is where you're heading. And, you know, it wasn't, I stayed at all these different places with people, you know, smoking meth and doing this and doing that, you know, having it offered to me in my face, I was still able to say no. And it wasn't until I was finally in an apartment on my own that I actually took the first sip of alcohol and some other things and relapsed. And I spoke with some people that have, you know, more time and experience than me about it. And I realized, like, I wasn't listening to them just to save how I looked. It's like, no, I'll prove you wrong. This isn't what I'm doing. Just watch my way work for me. And these, what I've done my whole life. I want to look good. You know, I want to be that beacon, but I'm not being honest with myself. I'm not telling you what I'm struggling with. I'm not telling you that everything is not okay. And it led me to a very dark place in my relapse. I had gone out for about a day, got back into the program immediately. Some of my close fellowship reached out to me the day after I relapsed to get back in to just the community and helping, you know, with addiction. I was hungover as hell helping with this fundraiser, and I was just like, let it stop. And I shouldn't be here, and I don't belong here. But the fellowship that I had didn't believe that. You know, I was trying, I isolated myself because of kind of what we had discussed earlier, how it would make me look or how I looked. And that wasn't the case at all. I made it a few weeks and things had gotten difficult again. I completely lost my serenity trying to focus on what I wanted and controlling how I wanted, you know, these things in my life to play out, trying to control other people, trying to control my job, trying to control just me, me, me. I really lost that serenity. It slipped away and I lost focus on it. And I went out again for about two nights this time. And I can see where my addiction wants to kill me at this point, just based off of my relapses. You know, I would have that sip of alcohol, and it was like it wasn't enough for me at this point. It was like I wanted to do more. I would go out looking for other things, and by the grace of God, it fell through every single time. And I'm blessed that intervention was there. I'm being completely honest with myself that this illusion that, you know, I'm this sort of like perfect person that hasn't made these mistakes, that hasn't gone through these things, that hasn't... I've made a lot of mistakes, and I'm looking at them now, and I'm evaluating them, because each time I don't face them or take direction from someone that just has, you know, my best interest at heart, it's led me to a lot of pain, it's led me to a lot of dark places, and I don't want that anymore. And this disease is in me. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. I can point my fingers all I want, but I'm realizing that my fingers are extremely dirty, and I need to take a look at that. Reconnecting kind of with a power higher than me that, you know, I call God, to just help me walk through this, because I can't do it. I'm really having to rely on a lot of faith and just accepting that I need help and talking about it, you know, and really just accepting that and realizing that I can't really control anything here except for my connection with something higher than me to help me. I hope to continue in my serenity. Every day I have a choice now, no matter where I'm at and what I'm doing. I want to be able to make the choices to have a better life for myself so that I may be able to reach out and have that feeling that I am helping someone. I want to realize that, you know, it's not about me. I really want to hold on to that hope, and I want to help nurture it and make it grow.